books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm Robert Kirkwood, and right now I'm at the Boswell Book Festival recording this year's shows. So today, let's hear from some of the audio collected over the years, including Dame Judi Dench, Nigel Havers, Alexander McCall Smith, and more.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
As I said, I'm at Dumfries House at the moment, recording for future editions of the ARIA-nominated audiobook show Read On. And if you've come across this show by scanning a QR code at Boswell, well, welcome in. Read On is recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. But as the tagline says, we're for everyone who loves books, and we're all about accessible reading. Today is a collection of some of the highlights from the world's only book festival for biography and memoir. First on today's show, though, here's an interview I recorded at Boswell in 2024. But it wasn't broadcast that year, as the audio version of the book wasn't available at the time. Well, I'm delighted to say it is now available commercially and also in the RNIB library. Night Train to Odessa, covering the human cost of Russia's war, is written and read by Jen Stout. Jen Stout is a correspondent, writer and radio producer from Shetland. When Russian tanks rolled into Ukraine, Jen left Moscow abruptly, ending up on a border post in southeast Romania, where she began to cover the human cost of Russian aggression. Night Train to Odessa begins in Russia and continues to focus on people in Ukraine. It is the account of a young female reporter with no backup and no security. Night Train to Odessa, covering the human cost of Russia's war, is read by the author.
I craned my neck to see the news programme playing on the TV at the end of the bar. It was the same fever pitch propaganda they'd been churning out for weeks now. On every state-controlled channel, claims of genocide in Donbass, claims that Ukraine was full of Nazis, ran incessantly. And there were no other news channels in Russia now. On my phone screen, though, I could follow, through Western outlets, the massive troop build-up, Russia's vast army moving into position on Ukraine's border. I could read the warnings of an imminent invasion. But here in Moscow, these were dismissed as hysterical Western hype. Next to me sat Andrei, a regular at the bar. He travelled for work, and I liked to hear his stories about distant parts of Russia I hoped to see. An easygoing, quiet type. "You know, I might have to leave," I said, still looking at the TV. "Why would you leave?" he shot back. His voice was suddenly clipped, angry. "Russia's not doing anything. It's all Ukraine, ramping things up. Ukrainian Nazis." I looked at him, astonished, as he went on about how terrible Ukraine was, what a badly run and corrupt country. I eventually interrupted to ask when he'd been there. "Well, why would I want to go there?" he muttered. "You've never been to Ukraine." He stared at me. "So what, have you?" "Yes," I said, wishing at this point that I was in Ukraine. "It's beautiful. Nice people." "It's a regime," he snapped. "Fascists." It was so out of character, I thought he might just be winding me up. "Come on," I said. "Are you serious? That's just propaganda. You're repeating what the TV says." And his retort, spoken into his pint glass as he avoided my eyes, summed everything up. "Yeah, well, your side is propaganda too." Night Train to Odessa is my account of covering the war in Ukraine as a freelancer. I start off in Russia because I was living there on a fellowship when the war broke out, which was the culmination of a lifelong kind of obsession with the Russian language and with Eastern Europe. But I'd been working as a journalist, so when I had to leave Russia, I thought I might as well go in the thick of it. And I started off in Romania on the border and then went on to report throughout Ukraine for the next 2 years. It's a very personal account. It's not dry or analytical, but it does weave in history and context because I want people to understand this war. But most of all, I want them to love Ukraine as much as I do. And the people and the places that I describe are just extraordinary. It had been a rough sea crossing when I left Shetland for Russia a few months earlier. 4-6 southwesterly, driving rain and poor visibility, a day of dirt, we'd say. From the ferry, the lights of Larwick, bloody through the rain-streaked porthole, glimmered and danced, then faded into the darkness. I'd waited what felt like all my adult life for this. Not leaving Shetland, I'd done that enough times, but moving to Russia. It began as an escape at 15, a high school class I actually wanted to attend, a whole new alphabet and syntax I couldn't get enough of, a teacher who encouraged me. Russian snared me. I'd say later I must have spoken it in a past life. I couldn't find any other way to explain it. With a huge fundraising effort, our teacher took the small class to St. Petersburg for a week, and my mind was blown. I watched the ice floes moving down the Neva, felt a fizzle of satisfaction pronouncing the instrumental case correctly to get lemon in my tea. I was fleetingly so happy.
You weren't always in Ukraine. You were heading back and forth from Shetland to Ukraine. How many visits did you make?
Five now. I lose track. Yeah, I do not recommend commuting between Kharkiv and Shetland. It's a long way and a lot of money. So, yeah, I would go, I had about 2 months at a time, I think, in those trips that I describe in the book. And I'd often be staying with friends in Ukraine or, you know, relying on the night trains, hence the title, or getting lifts with people, and often just reporting on my own because I can speak Russian. That was possible. But yeah, I mean, I had to learn a lot on the hoof. You know, I'd never covered a war before. I decided on that trip that I'd come back to this place. I'd sit exams, go to university, become fluent, become a correspondent. It was a nice dream. I did get a place in a Russian studies department, but the £1,500 fee for the year abroad was well beyond my means, and in our third year, my classmates set off for Perm without me. I switched to sociology, graduated and found a job teaching English in the Ural Mountains. But weeks before I was due to leave, my mother fell ill. A year of hospitals and hospices and fading hope followed. I made many more plans to get to Russia, but they always required at least some money, and I didn't have any of that. Why did I do this? Oh, that's a big question. I always wanted to do this, if I'm honest.
Right.
I grew up kind of reading Anna Politkovskaya, reading a lot of Martha Gellhorn and Steinbeck's reports on World War II, and I loved the human details in it and the way it brought everything home and moved me and helped me to understand the history and the context. I'd waited a very long time to go to Russia. I wanted to be a correspondent, but it's very difficult if you're working class to get into that world. It's very, very exclusive. And when I left Russia, I was happy that I was leaving. I didn't want to stay in that country, which I'd consider fascist, but I certainly didn't want to go home. And I thought, let's just do it. Let's just try. It wasn't until my late 20s that I got into journalism, with a bursary for training in Liverpool, a local newspaper job in a small Scottish town, and a slew of credit cards to keep my head above water. I wanted, most of all, to learn things, to learn everything. I wanted to live in other countries, especially Eastern European countries, and study languages, Polish, Ukrainian, Czech. I wanted to learn about the history and culture, the art and politics of other countries. I wanted all of it, desperately.
So it's not so much about the battles and the bombs, but it's about the people.
Well, there's some bombs, but they're incidental to the people, yes. The way that I travel and the way that I report allows me to stay in one place for a long time. Do you know, if it's interesting and have long conversations with people and birthday parties and kitchen tables and sitting in the park and just trying to understand their lives. I'm trained as a sociologist at university, and so I have an interest in identity, narratives, and how people are actually building a nation. You know, and I could just sit in the middle of that, soak it all up and try and describe it beautifully to you.
Now, we're sitting here recording this before the audio version has been released, but the listeners will have already heard a clip of the book, will know that the audio version's out and available now. Is it important to you that it's available to people, for whatever reason, don't have a relationship with the printed word?
Of course, it's totally crucial. I used to work in radio, Radio Shetland especially, the best radio station in the world. So I have a very keen appreciation of the power of audio and the connection between me and listeners. And it's very, very special and personal. Some of my favourite work that I did in Ukraine was for Radio Scotland. They would do the reporter's notebook, which has just allowed me a kind of big 5-6 minutes to just tell a story, describe a situation, and it would connect with people so powerfully. And that was when I would get messages for folks saying, oh, Ken, you were on the radio and I just had to stop the car, and or, do you know, I'd make people cry or laugh. And I knew that, like, when you do that, they're never going to forget what I was telling them. It's indelibly in their heart now, and I can do that through my voice, and that's a great pleasure.
You were saying your flak jacket and your helmet never fitted.
No, they're all made for men. And I'm quite a wee woman as well. So. Yeah, it's a problem. We're actually trying to address this. There are sort of specific female kit being made, and for soldiers as well. But it's very difficult to get flak jackets. They're very expensive. I usually get them on loan from organisations like Reporters Sans Frontières, and that's incredibly helpful and vital. But yeah, they don't usually fit that well.
The state TV channels were showing footage of grateful refugees, or confused and terrified Ukrainians, disembarking from trains in Russia, being handed soup and tea. Little children and old women from Donetsk escaping what the TV anchors said was shelling by the Ukrainian side. That case is Belli on repeat. Genocide, genocide, genocide. I feel sick all the time, a friend said as we messaged late at night. And it wasn't just us. I saw online the posts of many anti-war Russians I'd met, all talking about this lingering nausea. We all watched the maps and diagrams of the troop build-up along the border so close to Kharkiv. I checked in with a journalist I knew there. Well, we're doing as well as can be expected, he replied tersely, 40 kilometres away from all that. 2 days later, the bizarre spectacle of Putin's Security Council meeting aired on TV. The small dog and I watched from the sofa. When Valentina Matviyenko, the sole woman on the council, made a tearful and nonsensical speech about genocide in Ukraine, I realised she might actually believe it, and somehow that was scarier. Bottomless cynicism is one thing, lies to suit any occasion, but this teary woman seemed genuinely to think the claims were true. Of course, there was no genocide, it was a lie, but that didn't matter. As someone had said to me sniffily that same week, you have your truth, we have ours. And where can you possibly go from there?
Night Train to Odessa, covering the human cost of Russia's war, is available in print, as an e-book and an audio commercially, and an audio read by Jen herself in the RNIB library.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
And one author with many books in that library is Sir Alexander McCall Smith. I can't actually remember what led to this question, but I opened the interview by asking him how he would introduce himself to a Martian.
Well, I suppose I would introduce myself just for the benefit of the Martian as a person who writes books, and the Martian may then say, what are books? And I'd say that books are things that we're still enjoying in spite of advances in technology. And presumably in Mars you're in a post-book age, but we're still in the age of the book. I've got quite a number of series. I probably have about 5 or 6 series of books. I have the number one ladies detective agency series, which is set in Botswana, and that's all about the activities of a Botswana lady called Mara Matswi and her friends. I've just finished writing volume 25 of that series, and that'll come out in September this year.
Mara Matswi had a detective agency in Africa, at the foot of Kali Hill. These were its assets: a tiny white van, two desks, two chairs, a telephone, and an old typewriter. Then there was a teapot, in which Mara Matswi, the only lady private detective in Botswana, brewed Redbush tea. And three mugs, one for herself, one for her secretary, and one for the client. What else does a detective agency really need?
And then I have my Isabel Dalhousie series, which is one of my Edinburgh series. I've done 17 books in that series. And that's about a woman called Isabel Dalhousie who lives in Edinburgh and who is a philosopher. And she gets drawn into the problems of other people's lives, their issues. And so the books are largely concerned with those matters, with many of the practical philosophical issues that Isabel encounters in her daily life.
Isabel Dalhousie saw the young man fall from the edge of the upper circle, from the gods. His flight was so sudden and short, and it was for less than a second that she saw him, hair tousled, upside down, his shirt and jacket up around his chest so that his midriff was exposed. And then, striking the edge of the grand circle, he disappeared head first towards the stalls below. Her first thought, curiously, was of Auden's poem on the fall of Icarus. Such events, said Auden, occur against a background of people going about their ordinary business. They do not look up and see the boy falling from the sky. I was talking to a friend, she thought. I was talking to a friend, and the boy fell out of the sky.
Then I have a series called the Scotland Street series, which again has about 17 books. And that's a series that I started publishing in the Scotsman newspaper probably almost 20 years ago when I was asked to write a serial novel in the paper. And I thought that I would do that just for a year or so, but I've been doing it for a very long time. And that is set in Edinburgh in Scotland Street in the eastern New Town, and it follows the lives of a number of characters who live in and around Scotland Street.
Pat stood before the door at the bottom of the stair, reading the names underneath the buttons. Sim, MacDonald, Pollock. And then the name she was looking for, Anderson. That would be Bruce Anderson, the surveyor, the person to whom she had spoken on the telephone. He was the one who collected the rent, he said, and paid the bills. He was the one who had said that she could come and take a look at the place and see whether she wanted to live there. And we'll take a look at you, he had added, if you don't mind. So now, she thought, she would be under inspection, assessed for suitability for a shared flat, weighed up to see whether she was likely to play music too loudly or have friends who would damage the furniture, or, she supposed, whether she would jar on anybody's nerves. She pressed the bell and waited.
Then I've got a series that I've just started, a new series, called The Perfect Passion Company. The first volume in that series was published in February this year, and the next volume will be published next year on the same day, which is Valentine's Day. And that's set in a marriage bureau in Edinburgh, where the people come in asking the people who run the bureau to introduce them to suitable partners. And there are such firms, they fewer and far between when compared with the number that used to be, because nowadays most people meet their partners online through online dating. But there still exist these companies that will act as a screen, so to speak, and check up on the suitability of anybody with whom they put you in touch.
You said three husbands. Three? That was Elle, who was busy wiping a thin line of latte foam from her lips. A woman at a nearby table overheard this. A delicious snippet, she thought. Three husbands? She would tell her friends. Katie nodded. She's my cousin, or second cousin, shall I say, and she's had three husbands. She raised three fingers. Three! Siriatum, of course. Elle smiled. Siriatum. She rolled the word around her tongue. My father always called her his colourful cousin, mostly because of the men, you know. She's fond of them. Oh, well, said Elle. It can happen to anyone, I suppose. Mind you, to have had three husbands sounds a bit greedy, especially to those of us who have had none. Katie smiled. You'll find him. You've got plenty of time. Not that I'm looking, said Elle, adding, this week.
And I've got my Von Eichelfeld series, which is about German professors and so on. So the work of a serial novelist, really, is never done. It's never really done. They always have another book to write.
How have you got time to be out the house?
Well, I'm very, very fortunate in that I manage to write quite quickly. And so I keep parts of the day which are set aside for writing. And I do manage to lead an ordinary life as well as that.
Now, going back to Madame Remotswaite, you talked about a post-book world. That's become a podcast now.
Yes, they're very nice. They're very interesting. I think I've been interviewed by them. That's run by a Swede, Mats Ulgren, and they're very entertaining podcasts. He speaks to people who are associated in one way or another with the books or Botswana. He's a great friend of Botswana, that man who does them. And yes, the podcast has been great fun.
Now, you've written about places, not just Botswana, but all over the world. Are you travelling to these places or are you using Google Earth?
Well, I do tend to travel to the places that I write about. I think that's quite important. Google Earth is a great assistance to writers in that if you forget something about the geography of one of the places you're writing about, you've always got Google Earth to go and check up on it. But I think that it's very important to have some real acquaintanceship with the setting of your novels.
Now, we were talking earlier off microphone, and you said you're not really a fan of narrating your own books, although there is, for someone who doesn't like narrating their own books, you've done an awful lot of them.
I've done some of it. The reason why I would have reservations myself about doing it is that I think it's really, really difficult. You have to keep your voice up. And if you're doing an audiobook, which is going to take, some of them take 8 to 14 hours or whatever, obviously the shorter ones, not quite so demanding, I think that it's actually a physical business to make an audiobook. I think it's really probably best left to actors and experienced readers who know what they're doing. That's my view. Now, there will be authors who narrate their own books, and many of them do it really very well. So, for example, Ben McIntyre has done, I think the most recent one I listened to of Ben's was read by the author himself, and it was read extremely well. But it is a bit of an art, and actors are very good at it.
You're not an African woman.
Yes, that's a point.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
I do. I love audiobooks, and I probably not a day goes past but that I listen for at least a short time to an audiobook. I haven't really got terribly involved in listening to podcasts. I think podcasts are terrific. And if you look at the range of subjects that are covered by podcasts are really a wonderful resource. But I've never really got myself sufficiently organized to go and download them and follow them through. But audiobooks, yes. And indeed, I will listen to an audiobook more than once, actually. I've got some favorites that I'll go back to. I'm a great fan of the Map and Lucia novels, Benson's Map and Lucia novels, and I'll listen to them time and time again. Miriam Margolyes read one of those, and that's absolutely beautifully done. And I've listened to that six or seven times.
Now, I was just thinking about this as I was going to do the outro last time. You weren't a sir when we interviewed you. How's it been?
Well, absolute makes absolutely no difference to anything. And I mean, it was very kind of them. I'm not certainly was most touched by it. But you remain the same person. I suppose. I mean, there have been one or two moments where it seemed a bit odd to me when it's been apparent that the person with whom I'm talking is somehow regarding me differently, which, you know, I'm we're all Jock Tamson's burns, really, when it comes down to it. I mean, nobody's any grander than anybody else, really.
Right, then, well, Sandy, thank you so much.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
This edition of Read On is a celebration of the Boswell Book Festival at Dumfries House in Ayrshire, the world's only festival of biography and memoir. If you're listening to this on the weekend of release, this year's festival is happening now, both in person and online. Head to Boswell Book Festival, that's all one word, boswellbookfestival.co.uk for more. Still to come, we'll have a lesson in James Boswell himself from Yale academic Gordon Turnbull and Dr. Paul Tankard, and we'll hear from Dame Judi Dench. But for now, let's go back to 2017. You're listening to Read On, recorded at the Boswell Book Festival. Now, the Curtain Up event at this year's festival featured an evening with Nigel Havers, who was there to talk about his autobiography, Playing With Fire. The unabridged RNIB talking book version is read by Charles Armstrong.
By the time we came to shoot what would be the opening scene in Chariots of Fire, I had been inhabiting the skin of Lord Alfred Lindsay for several months. So, when Hugh Hudson, the director, asked if I felt able to age up in order to play my character as a man well into his 80s, I had little hesitation. The scene was a memorial service for the sprinter Harold Abrahams and took place in a London church. I had to spend 6 hours in makeup. As the face in the mirror got steadily older, I started remembering my grandfather, the way he walked, the way he talked and held his head. And as the finishing touches were at last applied, I suddenly remembered that Dad's chambers were just round the corner, so rang and invited him to come to the set and watch some of the morning's filming. When he arrived, he walked straight past me and professed not to recognise me at all until he heard my voice. I'm not sure if his reaction was genuine or whether he was doing it to give me pleasure. Either way, it was rather charming. My father was quite a guy. He had two passions, the law and living, the first providing the second. Law runs through the Havers family like blood runs through veins. My grandfather was Sir Cecil Havers, a notable High Court judge who was famous for, among other things, sentencing Ruth Ellis, the last woman to be executed in this country. My aunt is Dame Elizabeth Butler Sloss, also a High Court judge, and until recently head of the family justice system. My brother Philip is an eminent human rights barrister, and my niece Holly has recently joined one of London's largest firms of solicitors. Then there's me. Actually, I think every successful barrister has to have something of the actor in him. And Dad didn't just have a little something, he had it in spades. In 1981, as Attorney General, he was obliged to be chief prosecutor in the trial of Peter Sutcliffe, the notorious Yorkshire Ripper. On the day Dad started his case for the prosecution, I slipped into the viewing gallery. He had rung the week before to ask whether I wanted to come and see something special. "Is that the new play at the National?" I asked. "No," he replied. "I thought you might like to come and see me for a change." Peter Sutcliffe was surprisingly small, with wild, black, curly hair and very black eyes. The sort of eyes that have swallowed up the horror they have witnessed and sacrificed all life and expression in the process, leaving dark holes the colour of deadly nightshade in their place. When the judge gestured for proceedings to begin, my father got slowly to his feet. He stood, motionless, looking down at his notes. Silence. He stayed like that for several minutes, the tension building to breaking point. Just as the judge was about to intervene, he looked up, straight into Sutcliffe's eyes. Another silence. "Could you confirm how you spell your name?" he said. "One T and two Fs. Is that right?" Sutcliffe just nodded. Dad turned. There was a flurry of activity from the junior counsel huddled behind him. Everyone in the courtroom seemed to be holding their breath. Another long silence. I think the judge thought Dad had lost the plot. Eventually, Dad turned and fixed Sutcliffe with a hawk-like stare. "At least we've got that right," he said. "Tell me, did you enjoy killing those women?" The air suddenly seemed to have been sucked out of the room. It became difficult to breathe, and people started to lick their lips. I looked down and saw goosebumps on my arms. It felt as if the air conditioning had suddenly been cranked up to maximum.
So begins Playing with Fire by Nigel Havers. At the Boswell Book Festival, he told me about the book.
Well, the book is about me. You know, it took me... I spent 3 months writing this book. 9 to 5, like I was sort of going to an office, I did it. And I was sort of rather dreading doing it to begin with, but I really enjoyed doing it in the end. And I didn't have too much interference, and... there you are. It was a fun experience.
And you read the abridged version?
I loved that. I've done sort of radio and commercial voiceovers for years. So I love just talking into a microphone. I find that kind of rather restful.
Life was hell. The lack of food and sleep were beginning to turn me stark, staring bonkers. Added to which, looking back, I think I truly began to believe that I was William Wills. For the one and only time in my life, a part began to inhabit my being, and I started behaving very oddly. One day, as I was putting on my filthy old costume and having the makeup done, I noticed that the shot required us to be practically crawling on the ground. It was to be filmed by a sodding great long lens, and Graham and the crew were sitting miles away, waiting for us to get into position. "I'm not going anywhere until that director comes over to say good morning," I said. Shock registered on the face of the third assistant. This normally mild-mannered and quite cheerful actor throwing a hissy fit, or spitting the dummy, as they call it over there. He quickly walked over to Graham. "Nigel says he's not doing anything until you come and say good morning." Pause. "Has he lost his mind?" "Well, I think he means it." I screwed up my eyes and watched Graham, dressed in his habitual white linen, walk the 100 yards or so to where I was standing. "Good morning," he said. And he turned on his heel and walked back. The outback can do strange things to a person. One scene took place in a dust storm, and we had to have aeroplane propellers chucking dust in our faces for 3 whole days, unimaginably foul for us. Piece of cake for Simon and the rest of the camels. Those guys can survive anything. We also had to contend with the flies. I know everyone talks about those Aussie flies, but until you experience them at first hand, you can have no idea how hellish they make your life. I wore a hat with a net whenever I wasn't actually on camera, but on one close-up a fly actually walked across my eye, right across the middle. I'm quite proud of the fact that I didn't flinch, but the secret fact is that because I wear contact lenses, I was just about able to bear it. Another time we were filming on some salt flats. You could see at least 100 miles in every direction, everything dancing in that torrid heat. The crew were about 0.5 mile away, filming with the longest lens in existence. There is only one of those lenses in the entire world because it is so expensive to produce. Directors have to put themselves on a list and queue to use it, all of which adds to the pressures of filming, as there is absolutely no margin for error. Jack and I were acting up a storm, half crazed with thirst and exhaustion. One of us glanced over at the crew and found that they had broken for lunch and forgotten to send the runner to tell us. "I'll kill them," I yelled. Jack was able to find this quite amusing, but madman that I had become, I sulked for days.
Now, one chapter of the book stands out, your filming experience in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was because the character I played in that movie, Birkenwills, was such an extreme, you know, to die in the middle of nowhere, and it got under my skin a bit. But it was a good experience and an amazing story.
Especially when you got back to civilization and you couldn't leave the hotel room.
I couldn't, no. I hadn't... See, we lived, 800 miles from the nearest telephone or town. And after two months or so, you forget about things like traffic and noise and stuff. So when I came back to the big city, I got sort of agoraphobia. I couldn't leave. I couldn't leave the room. I couldn't cross the road. I tried to once, I just went straight back.
We eventually arrived in Adelaide, where we had a few days off before some more shooting just outside the city. It was terrifying. Suddenly, I found myself on my own in the middle of an enormous city, and I couldn't deal with the culture shock. By the time I got to my hotel room, I was a bundle of nerves, and I didn't leave the room for 2 days. I rang home to speak to Caro and give my love to Kate before I passed out. I just slept, ate room service food, and generally got my head together. The rest of the cast were doing exactly the same thing. We were all completely drained and exhausted.
Is it important that there's an accessible version of your book?
I actually have a sight problem myself, in fact. The retinal membrane at the back of my right eye is becoming unattached, so I have problems with my right eye, so even in that, I can understand how difficult it is to be blind, and I'm very aware of doing as much as I can to help.
Is that something that you're aware of on stage, like you have to be extra careful where your mark is and things like that?
I do now, yeah. I have to work much harder. It's putting a key into a keyhole is more difficult.
I realised I was grinning like an idiot. There was a light at the end of the tunnel. I knew things were never going to be easy, but there was just a chance that, together, we could get life back on track. With post-production schedules in Sydney, we weren't due back in London for a couple of months. Whatever the future held, I'd be able to take a break from playing with fire.
Nigel Havers, thanks so much for joining me on RNIB Connect Radio.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for asking.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The reaction to some of the first ever talking books was very positive.
Oh, huge success and huge excitement. At last, these people who have just come back from the war could actually start reading, and they could certainly see a way forward and were very encouraged by what they were doing. At last, blind and partially sighted people could now read.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
The Boswell Book Festival is named for probably the first ever biographer, the lawyer and diarist James Boswell, and it's held near his estate in Auchinleck in Ayrshire. Before we hear about Boswell from Yale historian Gordon Turnbull and Dr. Paul Tankard from the University of Otago in New Zealand, let's hear from the book The Life of Samuel Johnson. It's available from the RNIB Library, and all 67 hours and 31 minutes of it are read by Jonathan Oliver.
To Mr. Samuel Johnson, from Norfolk Street, April the 23rd, 1755. Sir, the part of your dictionary which you have favoured me with the sight of has given me such an idea of the whole that I most sincerely congratulate the public upon the acquisition of a work long wanted and now executed with an industry, accuracy and judgment equal to the importance of the subject. You might perhaps have chosen one in which your genius would have appeared to more advantage, but you could not have fixed upon any other in which your labours would have done such substantial service to the present age and to posterity.
Jonathan Oliver reading The Life of Johnson by James Boswell. Now, Dr. Gordon Turnbull is head of the Great Boswell Editorial Project at Yale University. I asked him if Boswell was somewhat of a forgotten figure.
Not exactly forgotten. That is, in the world of higher literary study, Boswell is a household name. He authored the great Life of Johnson and published it in the year 1791. That is a book which not only immortalized the great Dr. Johnson himself, who would have been immortal anyway through his own wonderful works, it also immortalized Boswell. It had the curious effect, however, of placing him in Johnson's shadow. That is, he became known for about the 150 years after his death as Johnson's biographer. Then in the 20th century came the remarkable recovery of his private papers, many of which had been stashed away at his ancestral home, Auchinleck House, a couple of miles from where we are now. Others had made their way across the Irish Sea to his descendants in Ireland called the Talbots of Malahide. Those papers were recovered after arduous and complicated effort, eventually sold to Yale University, which edits and publishes them. In the year 1950, there appeared the first volume of Boswell's private journal, the London Journal of 1762-63, and it rather astonished its academic editors by becoming a runaway worldwide bestseller. So Boswell has been known to literary history, but I would have to break that statement down into two parts. He became almost better known two centuries after his death than he was in his own immediate lifetime, and in some ways has been better known to literary history than he has been in the wonderful county of Ayrshire, the home of his ancestral estate, Auchinleck.
What sort of a job was that going through those papers?
In the original period, his descendants were fascinated by what they had, but were a little nervous about it. These days, in the 21st century, we take the idea of candid confessionality for granted. When I was confined at home by a ridiculous illness a few years ago, I inflicted upon myself 2 weeks of American daytime television and was shocked witless at what people admit to on national television. Boswell began to seem to me a paragon of reticence and self-concealment and pudicity. He's none of those things, but what it does show is how far ahead of the curve he was. His descendants in Scotland and then in Ireland didn't destroy the papers, although they did rip a few pages out, but they kept them, but were a bit understandably nervous about what we now know to be their very frank personal content. Boswell, well ahead of the post-Freudian era, the era of psychology and psychoanalysis and self-introspection, Boswell had a sense of writing as a therapy, as a way of assuaging the pain that we all will, as an inevitable feature of being alive, feel from time to time. And he knew the corollary of that, which was that people reading another person's account of distress and trying to battle through it would feel curiously and almost paradoxically comforted by that reading experience.
I think he was more important looking back than Johnson.
They were important in very different ways. Johnson will remain forever in the pantheon as a pioneering lexicographer. He was known for many years as Dictionary Johnson after his great and quirky but great Dictionary of the English Language came out in 1755. He was a brilliant moral essayist. His essays as The Rambler and The Idler stand up to reading now as burly, commonsensical, practical wisdom, lay sermons in a certain sense. His wry anti-novel, Rasselas, Prince of Abyssinia, will hold its own anywhere as a coming-of-age story, a quest for experience and knowledge that goes a bit funny at the end. It may even be that the young people know more than the elderly tutor Imlac actually does. They were different kinds of people. Boswell, now known as a pioneering figure in biography, but also a pioneering figure given his 20th century literary rebirth in the kind of candid confessional writing that Johnson himself would not have undertaken, being a very different personality.
Now, Johnson is famously, or perhaps as a joke, he's derisory to the Scots, and Boswell was a proper Ayrshireman. Did the two of them get on?
They got on famously. It's a complicated story, and I'm not even sure I, at this distance of time, can actually unravel how serious and how jokey Johnson was when he occasionally cracked his clever but sarcastic wit against the Scottish nation. We all know the famous dictionary definition of the word oats, a grain which in England is fed to horses, but which in Scotland supports the people. Boswell, who occasionally gave back as good as he got, was heard to remark, "Ah, sir, but what horses and what people?" To speak seriously for the moment, there were antagonisms between Scotland and England, even with the Union of the Crowns in 1603 and the Act of Union in 1707. English people like Johnson, who were alive at the time of the second Jacobite uprising, never really knew if there might be another one at some future point. There were political and doctrinal realities. Some of the witticisms, I do think, were just that, and a few of them were made playfully at his friend Boswell's expense. I'll say this about Boswell. He himself undertook the re-education of Dr. Johnson. Their famous tour to the Highlands and Hebrides in 1773 is one in which the older man was educated by the younger. Boswell tells us in his journal of a tour to the Hebrides that Johnson went home in great good humour, with his prejudices much lessened, and very grateful for the hospitality he'd been shown here, proving yet again that most things like national prejudices really are no more than a function of ignorance and occasionally arrogance.
Now, while Gordon Turnbull oversees Boswell's papers, Paul Tankard from the University of Otago in New Zealand has a different approach.
My collection is a collection of things that he did write for publication, but in ephemeral forms in newspapers and magazines. So he wrote 600 or so pieces for newspapers and magazines, and on the whole, they haven't seen the light of day since the 18th century. They get occasionally looked at by scholars who are wanting to fill in Boswell's biography, but no one's really looked at them in their own right as a body of material. And I was fascinated by the idea that there were these 600 things out there that had never been sifted through, gathered together. And so the challenge for me was to craft out of that a book that would represent Boswell as a journalist in all of his capacities. It could have been twice as long. There were other categories of material I could have included: his theatre reviews, his book reviews, and things about the law. He wrote about the law quite a bit, but instead I confined it to what I thought people would find most interesting: the life of Johnson, material about executions, actual reportage that he did, and a series of political, scurrilous political essays that he called The Rampager.
These were published anonymously, so did he keep copies of them, or did you have to go look for them following clues in his journal?
Last century, Frederick Pottle, who was in charge of the Boswell Editions office before Gordon Turnbull, he had done most of the bibliographical work on Boswell, and using Boswell's journals and also using Boswell's collections of clippings — Boswell kept everything, and as we heard before, the family kept everything as well — using those materials that only came to light in the early 20th century, it became possible to begin to identify the things that Boswell had written for newspapers.
We think fake news is something of today, but Boswell was quite a practitioner of fake news in his day.
In a sense, in the 18th century, most of the news was fake, or at least news that was true was the exception. Or we could put it another way and say that the things that were in newspapers, nobody expected them to be true. Some of them were, some of them weren't. What the newspapers recorded were things simply that were in circulation. And I don't think anybody had a real expectation that if you read it in the newspaper, it was necessarily true. It might have been, or it might not have been, and it didn't sort of matter a lot. I suppose if they were reporting the shipping news and court movements, things like that, they would have been accurate. But when it came to reporting other things like, you know, a certain literary gentleman was seen dining at the home of a certain Hibernian cleric visiting London, then people weren't identified, people who are in the know might have known what was being referred to, it might have been true, it might not have been. There are all sorts of other reasons for things being in the newspaper. And it was a completely different way of conceiving the newspaper, and it was more like the blogosphere of today. It was things that people wanted other people to think true or false.
Not much has changed.
Well, I think that, in fact, in the 20th century, when a lot of papers wanted to identify themselves as journals of record that could be relied upon to represent what had gone on a day-to-day basis, that's a bit of an anomaly, really, and that it's a sort of a 20th century invention. And in the 18th century, I think that newspaper readers would have read far more critically and cynically than we do, thinking to themselves, well, I wonder why this is in the newspaper, and I wonder who's contributed to it. And that was part of the story. Who might have put it in, who might have contributed it, what might their interest have been, and then to assess whether it might have been true and might have been false.
And Boswell used the newspapers to his own ends.
Oh, yes, yes. If he had a cause that he was involved in, he wouldn't hesitate to publicise it through the papers. At the end of his career, when he devoted himself mostly to writing the life of Samuel Johnson, for the 9 years that he was writing it, he would feed the newspapers things about Johnson and about himself and about the life of Johnson, about other biographers of Johnson, all of which he hoped would keep up interest. And none of these things would have his own name on them, or some of them. The occasional one would when he wanted to make an official pronouncement, but most of the time they wouldn't have his name on them. They were just little things that were intended to keep people thinking, oh, Samuel Johnson is still important, is still an issue, and Mr. Boswell is still working on his biography, and that's all interesting and exciting. And if he, a couple of times he was involved in legal cases that he wanted to sway public opinion, or at least he wanted people to be interested in the case, and he would again feed things to the newspapers about what was going on in the case, and not under his own name, of course, because that would have undermined it. So it was a way of affecting the climate of opinion and keeping something current.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
I was just telling everybody else I was okay, and I just didn't know how to cope with it.
Initially, I felt really lost.
That's when I contacted the RNIB.
More than ever, I just feel seen and heard as a visually impaired person.
Sometimes you just need someone to guide you through it all.
Losing your sight shouldn't mean losing out on life. Leave a gift in your will to RNIB and help people with sight loss live the lives they want. Search RNIB Will Guide to find out more.
And finally, on today's show, recorded at the Boswell Book Festival, let's go back to 2018.
Dame Judi Dench's first professional debut was as Ophelia in the Old Vic's 1957 production of Hamlet. And over the next 20 years, she established herself as one of the greatest actresses of the post-war period, taking on all of Shakespeare's leading female roles, from Cleopatra to Lady Macbeth. Her first starring role in film was as Queen Victoria in Mrs. Brown, a role she reprised in Victoria and Abdul. And of course, she recently played M in 7 James Bond films. And as Red Sail found out, it appears she has some royal fans.
Now, I hear you're here by royal invitation.
I am here. The Prince of Wales asked me to come up to Dumfries House and do the opening of the book fair, and I said absolutely no second bidding required. I was thrilled. I love Scotland, love it. And so very easy for me to say yes.
And you're no stranger to playing royal parts both on stage and on the big screen. When you're playing a character like Queen Victoria, do you do much background research reading?
I did a huge amount of background on Mrs. Brown. Huge amount. So, I mean, I and a whole lot of other people didn't know, really, about her friendship with Abdul. It was only very recently that all the letters and things were found, written by her in Urdu, and so nobody realised what they were. And so it was wonderful, having done Mrs. Brown, to kind of, you know, think of those few years, and then suddenly she had, you know, the delight of having this lovely young man who taught her things, who she was able to talk to, who taught her to write in Urdu, who had a wonderful sense of humour, and you know, I'm sure brought extra years to her life.
Are you a very keen reader yourself?
No, I can't read at all. I can't read at all now because of my eyesight.
So macular degeneration has taken away all ability to read text, has it?
Yes, I get taught scripts and things by friends, and you know, you adjust so quickly to something like that. Just adjust to it, and fortunately it doesn't happen overnight, but it happens during a length of time, and then you somehow adjust to that.
I know you've narrated a lot of books, audio books.
Not many. I'm no good at it. I tell you, the person, my husband, Michael Williams, was wonderful at it. And my daughter, Finty Williams, she's won 7 awards. She's simply wonderful at audio books.
And she's an RNIB narrator. I know The Tale of Emily Winsnap is actually one of my daughter's favourite books.
Oh, I'm very glad, and I'll tell Finty. She'll be very glad, too.
So do you listen to audiobooks yourself much nowadays?
No, but I'm going to start and do that. I just think I've got such a lot to catch up on. You know, I miss the whole thing, reading, and I used to paint a great deal, and I gave up painting. And then it was a friend of mine who said, you know, really, you know, you don't paint for anybody else, you paint for yourself. So I'll paint what I think I can see, and that doesn't matter. It's not, you know, for a gal. You know, everyone gets frightened and thinks somehow it's going to be on display. It's not going to be on display at all. It's just going to be for my own pleasure. So every Tuesday I go and paint. It's lovely.
And, of course, the advantage of listening to a talking book is that you can paint as well because your hands are free.
And it's so glorious, a talking book on a long journey. I mean, what could be better? If you have a long journey to do and you have a story to be told, I think it's irresistible.
Do you have a wish list that you'll be going to the RNIB Talking Books Library with?
My wish list is almost everything that's come out in the last 10 years. I'm going to be kept busy.
And obviously you're still acting as well. I heard you say on the news last night that you wouldn't stop acting until you started tripping over the furniture. Have you got...
Done that. Tripped over the furniture. Yes, I'm filming at the moment with Ken Branagh, and then I'm going to do a film with Eddie Izzard in the summer, and then I think I'm going to do another one in the autumn.
It sounds like you're keeping extraordinarily busy, and you have signed hundreds of books this morning, by the looks of it.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it?
Keeping literacy going in the UK.
I hope so.
Well, Dame Judy Dench, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. As I said, I'm at Boswell right now recording future editions of Read On, so listen out for them soon. You can hear last year's shows, or around about 470 episodes of Read On, if you just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. And remember to tune in to our sister show, Talking Books, which is on every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m, showcasing the best the RNIB library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. You can find us at rnib.org.uk/connect-ready.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.